Welcome to Song Creating on Radio St. Pete Sunshine 96.7 FM. Join us as we celebrate the sparks that ignite, the events that inspire, and the songwriters that create. With your host, Steve Robb.
Susan Levine has been many things: a graduate of Harvard, a waitress, an actress, a mother, and a music therapist. But she has always been a musician. After a childhood spent singing in Medford, Massachusetts, Susan learned guitar in college and spent time after graduation traveling the country, writing and performing before settling in Boston in 1998. 3 years later, she released her first album, Scatter Me, followed by Atlas in 2007. Since then, she has not stopped writing or performing. Through a painful divorce, single motherhood of two young boys, working as a music therapist, and performing and recording as one half of the American duo, The Lied To's, music has remained a constant focus in her life. So Susan Levine, welcome to Song Creating.
Thank you, Steve. It's great to be here.
It's wonderful to have you from Medford, Massachusetts.
Medfa, yes.
You grew up in Medford.
Yes.
Is that right? And now you're back here.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, so I grew up in Medford and I went to college in Cambridge and then moved to New York, New Mexico, California, and then back to Massachusetts. And
so now, are you reluctant to say Harvard now?
Because
it's already in your bio.
Okay. Yeah, I know.
It's all right. It's okay.
Yeah, I went to Harvard. And then I traveled. Then I moved to New York to do musical theater. And I was in New York for 5 years. And then I moved to Santa Fe, New Mexico, and then Stockton, California, and then back here.
So how was this musical theater experience in New York?
It was great when I was working. So I moved out there after college. Basically, in college, I was an English major and I did theater for 4 years. I did like 3 or 4 shows a semester. And my dad called it theater camp, which it kind of was. And then I moved to New York and I started with an internship at a theater called Circle Rep. And then I got the first show I auditioned for, which was an off-Broadway production of a show called Star Mites, which had run off Broadway for a while. And one of the stars of it decided he wanted to direct it. So he directed an off-Broadway production of it in Midtown. So I did that. And then I was cast in a new show, where how I got my Equity card. It was an off-Broadway production called Prom Queens Unchained, which ran at the Village Gate in the West Village for a while. And it was a story of prom queens in a high school in 1959. And it was when that environmental theater stuff was really big. So like Tony and Tina's Wedding. So it was like people would come in and, you know, as an audience member, you'd get your bag lunch and you'd sit at a big long cafeteria table and we'd put on a show and the audience was kind of involved. So did that, and then I did a bunch of tours, mostly of children's theater, and I did a tour of A Christmas Carol in Europe. And then after 5 years, I was a little tired of life there, and my boyfriend at the time, who I met doing a tour of A Christmas Carol, he wanted to get his degree, a master's degree in Eastern philosophy, so that's how I ended up in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Ah, so what defines off-Broadway and off-off-Broadway? Is there a geographical distance from
yeah, I think it's like size of the theater, but it's also like whether it's equity or non-equity. So I got my union card doing the off-Broadway show, whereas the off-off-Broadway show is not union. But I do think it has something to do with the size of the theater as well.
Is there an off-off-off-Broadway? Maybe.
Probably, yeah.
Somebody's backyard, maybe.
Yeah. Somebody's basement somewhere
right.
In Manhattan. Yeah.
Right. So that's a lot of uncertainty, it sounds like, in the course of that life. Were you always thinking, were you thinking that this could be my life? Or was it did you look at it as a stepping stone into something else?
I thought it was going to be my life. I mean, I thought maybe I would go into TV and film as well. But I think what happened was, you know, because I got the show early on, and I didn't know what I was doing. So like I moved to New York, I had done theater all through college, but I had no idea professionally, like how to audition, how to do what I was supposed to do. And so I kind of was going by the seat of my pants, which really worked for me, because for me, the more I know, the more I get in my head and then I mess myself up. Mm-hmm. So having gotten some stuff early on, I had an agent, I had, you know, sort of more pressure, you know, my parents were expecting more and I was expecting more of myself. And so, and then I had to make a living at it. And so when that started to happen, I started to kind of get into my head a little bit more and not do as well at auditions. Also trying to get into TV and film, I always looked a lot younger than I was. So I was going on stage, I could play a teenager or a young teenager, but in film, it doesn't read, you don't read as young. You know, you can see every little nuance. So when I would go up for these parts for TV and film, you know, I'd walk into the audition room and they'd be like, yeah, you look like you're 22, you know, so see ya. So like I was, this is dating me, but I was called in for The Professional, you know, that movie with Natalie Portman. It was like her big breakthrough movie. She was actually 13. I was like 21, like going in pretending to be 13. And they were like, oh, no.
Okay. So were you doing this in high school also, in junior high, middle school, all that?
Yep. I was all, theater.
It's been a big deal. Wow. What did you think about Santa Fe?
I loved it. It's my favorite place on earth.
Were you doing music there too? Or did you get into something else?
So I moved there. Like I said, my boyfriend at the time was getting his degree in Eastern philosophy at a college called St. John's. And so I moved there with him. I didn't know anybody. And I got a job in a restaurant singing Broadway show tunes and serving enchiladas. Basically, it was a place called the Cantina, and it was amazing.
Perfect spot for you coming out of New York.
It was amazing. I made more money doing that than I've made since, because it was the heyday of like tourist time there. And so we would just, there was a pianist and there was a tip jar on the piano, and we would serve food. And then you'd go up, the pianist would play your little, like an interlude that was like your cue. And then you'd go up and you'd pick a song and you'd sing your song, and then you'd go back to your table. So your tables became very invested in you, like, oh, that's our waitress up there, you know, and then we'd have some group numbers that we did. It was a lot of fun. And it was like amazing. And that's where I actually didn't start playing guitar in college. I don't know where that bio is, but I started playing when I was leaving New York. And then when I started writing, when I moved to New Mexico.
In Santa Fe.
Yeah.
Okay. So you weren't really writing music at this time until later.
No, I have a couple of songs that I wrote in New York that were really bad, a couple of first songs. But that's where sort of the bug of like songwriting came in. I was on a tour, actually the tour in Europe, and somebody, again, dating myself, somebody put a cassette of Steady On, Sean Colvin's cassette, in the van. And I was like, who is this? This is amazing. And that's kind of put the bug in me to want to start singing and songwriting.
Were your first songs kind of that Broadway feel to it?
No, not at all.
Not at all. No. There's a difference. I've been thinking about that recently, because I saw Jagged Little Pill, which takes, you know, this amazing rock album and turns it into a Broadway show. And I actually saw it 4 years ago off Broadway at the in Cambridge. Just a spectacular show. And that music wasn't written for Broadway, yet it works. You know, they did a great job interpreting it for this, and I highly recommend it to anybody. But when you do hear a Broadway show song, there's something about it that's different, that identifies it. And is there a way to describe that? I mean, there's a storyline that it has to have, but there's something more. It's key changes and modulations.
I think there's a presentational quality about it. You know, it's more presentational. They are doing a lot, like just like Jagged Little Pill. Like a lot of shows on Broadway right now are taking pop songs and making them into musicals. Like there's the Michael Jackson musical, there's a Donna Summer musical. There's this thing now called Anne Juliet that's all pop songs. So they're making that shift right now. But True Broadway, even like one of my favorite shows is Big River, and all the music is by Roger Miller. But there's still like a present, and it's about Huck Finn. But there's still like a very much more presentational quality. And I think when I heard Sean Colvin, and definitely when I heard Dar Williams, and this is all when I was in New York doing theater, there was some kind of light bulb that went off, like, oh, you can sing the way you talk. Like, you don't have to be big and brassy, or you don't have to have any kind of special words. Like these people are really sort of singing the way they speak, and there's poetry in it, but it feels really right. And then when I started writing and singing my own stuff, it felt so much more comfortable and right to me than singing the Broadway stuff ever did.
As a kid in the, you've already dated yourself, so I'm thinking you're a kid probably in the 80s or so. What were you listening to? I mean, you weren't listening to Broadway shows or were you?
I was, as a
kid.
I was listening to, so my dad is a huge country music fan. He's a nice Jewish boy from Brooklyn, but loves classic country. So Willie Nelson, Emmylou Harris, Dolly Parton, Johnny Cash, all of that stuff was playing in the house when I was growing up. And then my mom loved Broadway musicals. So that's where I got that from. So they would take us to shows in Boston, or they were from New York. So we'd go to New York and see shows in New York. So it was like those two things. And then typical 80s music and pop music that my friends were listening to as well. But I always kind of gravitated towards Emmylou and Dolly and that kind of country thing, which is also, I guess, now that I'm thinking about it, the storytelling of the Broadway tunes and the storytelling of the classic country stuff kind of came together as an influence, which I didn't think about until right now.
Is there a good country music musical out there?
Big River, I think, would be the best right now. There's also a new Dolly Parton musical out there as well. But I think Big River would be, my audition song, for example, in New York was a song called Maybe Leaving's Not the Only Way to Go, which was from Big River. So I always had that country bent to my voice, which I couldn't escape even on Broadway.
You do have a little bit of that. You're a soprano, I think, right?
A mezzo, yeah.
A mezzo soprano, which is a higher soprano.
It's in between alto and soprano.
Okay. So, I should know these things, but that's beyond my vocal range, so I don't know much about it. Okay, so tell me about these first couple songs you wrote. You said they were terrible, which is what everybody so far on this podcast has talked about their first songs. I think to a person. What inspired them? What inspired you to write, I guess, is perhaps a better question.
Well, I think, like I said, traveling around in a van for hours at a time, and having my Walkman or my CD, whatever, Discman, whatever it was. I think, again, I was listening to like Sean Colvin, Dar Williams, Lyle Lovett. All these people were kind of these inspirations, Patty Griffin, in my head.
Yeah.
And I wrote about my relationships, which is what I kind of still do. But I think my first couple of songs were based on my very early relationship with this person. So when I went to
So were they positive songs? Were you in a positive relationship?
No.
Yeah.
I mean, they were. My songs are never really. There's never like a really positive. Like it's all gray, and there's never a black and white. Oh, all good, all bad. It was most of them are about leaving, which is often what I write.
I'm starting as I'm interviewing more and more people and getting a better sense of all the songs that are written out there. And I don't know what percentage of them are, if we can define them as broadly as happy and sad or dramatic and I'm not sure what the opposite of that might be. But like TV, you got your sitcoms, but what really gets the audience? It's the NCIS, it's the dramas. I think there's a good correlation there somehow. And the blues is like that. People love the blues. Blues makes people happy. I think there's something about misery loves company kind of thing. And there are the classic love songs, I guess. I've always found that in country, it's funny that the men, and I'm talking, I think I should be talking current country, although I don't know enough about the past over the all the iterations of what country music has been. But now the men's songs that the men are singing are always, they're in love with this girl and they can't get enough of her. And the women are always singing, they've had enough of this guy. Yeah. Can't we get away from him?
Well, because the men are like, you're wearing your, you know, cut off jeans and you're in my truck and, you know. Let me think about my early songs, and then they were about travel and as they progress, as I moved to Santa Fe, they tended to be to broaden a little bit, but my first couple of songs were very much about the relationship.
Yeah.
You're listening to Song Creating on Radio St. Pete, Sunshine 96.7 FM.
From Santa Fe, you moved back to Boston, I think, right?
No. So in Santa Fe, because that's where I started writing more seriously, and not seriously, but mm-hmm. there's something about the air out there and the mountains, and just the atmosphere is so creative and so... I really just like my days were great. Like I'm right now, like by 8 o'clock at night, I just want to go to bed. But like there, I was working at night, which was a perfect thing for me. So like I wake up in the morning and take my dog on a hike and come back and write songs and then go to work and then like do it again the next day. And it was just a very nice, easy life. And so my songs got a little bit bigger there and, more expansive.
Is there a big music community there? Because it certainly is an artist community, yeah. But more painters and photographers, I think that I hear about at least than musicians. But is there a strong music?
I would say not as strong as it is here, but there was, at least when I was there was that community there. And, you know, in fact, I hooked up with these guys who played at this local coffee shop and they had me sing with them. So like there was a lot of support. And in fact, I played an open mic at the Cowgirl Hall of Fame. That was my first open mic that I played there. And I played a couple of songs. And then the host asked me to do a gig there. And I was like, okay. And it was like a 3-hour gig. And I had like six of my own songs and maybe a couple of 3-chord covers. So, I pulled my friend Jimmy Lee over and I'm like, you got to teach me some songs. So I learned like a million 3-chord covers. And if you listen to my first songs, they're all really long because I just would add verses and choruses because I had 3 hours to fill. But there was a nice supportive music community when I was there.
Yeah. Okay. So we're from Santa Fe.
Okay. So then I was very happy in Santa Fe. And so, as is my personality, I decided I can't just be happy waiting tables and writing songs and singing. I have to do something with my life. So a while back, somebody had put a bug in my ear about music therapy, which is what I do now. And I was like, well, I'm interested in music and I'm interested in psychology. So let me apply to school for music therapy. So I applied to graduate programs. One was in Boulder, one was in Stockton, California at the University of the Pacific, and then the other one was back here at Lesley. And the one in California gave me some money and I was supposed to be a graduate assistant, so I decided I would go there. So that brought me to Stockton, California. So
okay. That's because I wanted to lead into the music therapy, which I'm interested in hearing more about what that entails.
Okay. So music therapy is the use of music basically to accomplish non-musical goals, which could be anything from neurologic music therapy, where you use rhythm and tempo to help maybe a Parkinson's patient improve their gait, or you help a stroke patient learn to speak again. So there's that, but it's also, it's birth to death, basically. So I work in early intervention, which is children and families with from birth to three. And then I also have a couple of private preschool clients and kindergarten clients. But they use music in the NICU for babies to help regulate their heart rate and improve sucking. And you can use it with school age kids to work on speech and language or to work on social emotional issues, psychiatric patients. So basically the application is sort of lifelong. What I do is sort of a combination of what's called developmental music therapy and kind of neurologic music therapy. I work with children with disabilities, and whatever their need is their non-musical need is what I attack through music. So if it's a child with autism, for example, we'll have a drum between us and we might, you know, we work on the I play, you play, we play. So getting that communication, the very basic communication through music, that maybe verbal communication isn't, you know, isn't happening for them. So we just work on that general communication that way. Or if I have a child with, some kind of neurologic issue, cerebral palsy, I might work on them reaching for the guitar and strumming the guitar, isolating their fingers to play the keyboard. But the trick is that we all do music for a reason, right? So we all, it touches us in some way. It makes us feel something. It's emotionally connecting. So it feels like play. The trick is to make it feel like play to the child. So instead of feeling like physical therapy, oh, I have to reach for this thing, like got to make it music so that they want to do it. And so it doesn't feel like they have to work, but you are working. There's always something behind the technique that you're using.
Yeah. So I'm curious about the infants and the sucking. And is there, I mean, are you using nursery rhymes and that classic, you know, baby kind of music that we all know?
That's for in the NICU, but yes. I mean, if I were to work with a baby for feeding, yes. Or just making it up as you go along and using, there's a heartbeat music therapy also. So 60 beats a minute, if you've got that going, and that can help them, you know, with the rhythm of the suck. Whereas maybe they're a little disorganized, the rhythm of the music is what helps them kind of, is very organizing. It's organizing for most of us.
So do you find, pardon me for interrupting, find that the tempo of the music, the beat at 60 per second, does that help to regulate the child physically to that same tempo?
Often it does, yes.
Really?
Not always, but often it will, or at least will calm. Anything under 60 beats a minute is supposed to be sort of sedating and regulating and quieting, and anything over it is kind of helps you. But it's always a balance. I mean, you're always like starting where the person is and then figuring out how you need to regulate and what you need to do with the music in order to help them reach the optimal level of being.
What do you think about listening to Beethoven in your utero? Does it work?
I mean, at 6 months of age, at 6 months in utero, kids can hear. You can hear. Infant can hear. So it doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
But I would say even if, say, the mother or the dad, if they like, I don't know, punk, or if they like Johnny Cash, or if they like Social Distortion, you know, whatever it is, if the parents are happy, the child is happy. You know what I mean? So like the Mozart effect, I mean, it's not necessarily accurate, but
I tend to think hearing their parents' voice is better than hearing Beethoven.
It is, and that's what I tell parents all the time. Even if you think you can't sing, your baby has been hearing your voice and loves your voice. So
your
baby thinks you can sing. So
yeah, so. Right, neat. Now, were you when you had your children? Were you a music therapist at that time?
Yes.
So, and did it help with them? Were you able to calm them down by singing to them as 18-year-olds?
Not now, but I have very strong memories of my older boy. Like he, at around 6 weeks, he got very fussy and walking up and down the sidewalk singing "Sweet Baby James" and singing certain songs that helped calm him down. But
yeah,
I didn't quite use music therapy with them, but yeah.
That's fun. I think I had my most success with my first one who had a screaming fit. And I just ran her all around the house, and we'd stop and look at a clock, and then we'd take off and run again. And we'd stop and look at something else and look at it. And I spent a half a second at each of these things. And she was so confused that she just stopped crying. And I think that probably worked better than me singing at the time.
Yeah. We used to run around. We had dance parties to this record we had called New Baby Train. And it was like, I can't even remember who it was, but it was like this crazy bluesy blues music. And we would have these dance parties and to it. And that helped as well.
Yeah. So you are now, you're a single mom raising these two boys. But you are half of the duo, the Lied Twos, with a previous guest we've had on Song Creating, Doug Kortler. But you're also more than just musical partners.
Yes.
And tell us a little bit about that relationship and that working relationship.
So he got, I listened to his Song Creating podcast, and he got a little bit of the timing wrong as far as how we met.
Did I get it wrong or did he get it wrong?
Oh, he got it wrong.
Oh, well, I hope
I corrected him. But
most guys don't really remember all the details.
Right. So so we first met at the North Shore Folk Festival in 2010. So he messed up the date somehow. But
okay.
So but we met right before Nick Noble at WICN in Worcester had us all on to promote the festival. And I think he's told the story that he remembered my guitar more than he remembered me, because I play a Gibson LG1, 1958 Gibson. And so guys are all about guitars. And so he was like, can I play your guitar? Like basically, but we were both married at the time. I didn't think anything of it. Didn't really remember that. And then fast forward a couple of years later, I had gone through my divorce, and my ex-husband is also a producer and sound engineer with his own recording studio. And so I needed a new place to record. And Mark Stepakoff said, why don't you go to Doug? And I was like, oh yeah, Doug. And so that's how we started. I had him record one of my songs. And when he played me the final product, it was exactly what I heard in my head. And so that kind of was, and he was in the middle of going through his divorce. But eventually we started, like, he asked me to open a show for him, and then we started backing each other up and playing, and that was fun. And then it evolved into a romantic relationship as well.
That sounds like a very nice organic process.
It was, because I had done some online dating, which was miserable. I had a horrible experiences. And so then meeting somebody and having this immediate connection in person was really nice.
Sure. Made a big difference. And your voices go together very well, because they actually are very different. And I like, it's easy to define the two of you.
Yeah.
You know, as you hear it, which we'll hear in the song coming up here called Time by the Lied Twos. But this is your song that you wrote.
Yeah.
Why don't we take a break, and we'll come back. We'll hear that song, and we'll start up again. All right.
Okay. All right.
Are you lying to yourself again? That everything that's come before. For me, it's easier to forget sometimes than to love you anymore. So I don't remember what you said to me when you slipped that ring onto my hand. Thing about time. just couldn't get it right. Are there pictures in your mind? A little something left behind. 'Cause there's nothing left in mine. And that's the best thing. Table, telling stories I should know. I can't recall a single moment. That's the beauty of letting go.
Welcome back to Song Creating. We're here with Susan Levine. Susan, this song, it's the simplest name, Time, but boy, it's got a lot in there. And I have to, before we even talk about this song, I love this line: "How the room looked like a tapestry, and it all unraveled strand by strand." Wow, that's such a great line.
Thank you.
Is that one where when it comes to you, you just smile and go, ah?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, I'm assuming that it did, because if it came to me like that, that's what I would do. I would just go, ah, that's great. Maybe I actually am good at this. I mean, that's just a beautiful line. I love it.
Thank you.
Says so much. And has this been released on an album?
Yeah, it's on our newest album. So this is on our album called The Worst Kind of New, which I think we released March of 2022, I think.
Okay, with the Live Tubes, right?
Yeah.
And did you write this one recently, or is this something from the past?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote it a few years ago. The story, I have two kids, and I'm divorced, and my younger son plays drums, and we were at a drum recital, and my dad was there, my mom, my brother, my kids, Doug, and my ex-husband. We were all there, and my dad likes to take people out to eat. So after the recital, he was like, "Oh, you guys want to go to lunch?" And everybody said yes, including my ex-husband. And so we were at this local restaurant in town. I live in Newburyport. It's a place called Michael's, which we go to a lot. And my ex is sitting across the table from me. Doug is next to me. My parents are there, you know, my kids, my brother. And my ex looks at me and he starts telling all these stories from our life together, and looking at me like kind of funny things, and looking at me like he thought I should be laughing and, like, you know, just participating in the reminiscence. And I did, like, I smiled, I chuckled, and, like, you know, 'cause I'm nice and I'm polite. But afterwards I just was thinking about it, and how, like, I could remember everything he was talking about.
Were they good? I mean, positive?
Yeah, they were
stories?
Like good memories. They were like kind of funny incidents. Okay. That had happened. And I could remember them visually, but not necessarily, but emotionally, you know, everything had shifted. So I think a lot about time and about like what you do with those memories and what you do with past relationships when they're done. And so that's where the song came from. And every image in it is completely true, including the tapestry, because his dad, when we got married, in his dad's house, and he had these huge tapestries on the wall. And so that's where that line came from.
Have you can you share with us some of the stories that he was telling, if you recall them, and how maybe you experienced it differently, how you recalled it from the different from the original?
I can't really remember the exact stories, but I think one of the things I always think about with the song is that it's a very unreliable narrator. You know what I mean? Like it may seem like I'm saying, I don't remember anything. See? And that's kind of like, but it's not that. It's really like, I do remember. And it does still hurt to think about these things. You know, it's kind of that gray area of like, these things are still pretty painful, but we all have to get them.
And it's such a different part of your life. It's almost like, did that all just happen? Did that really happen? You know, you're almost looking at it from a third person point of view. And I wonder sometimes if that's because there's a photograph somehow that captured that. And you're remembering not so much the experience, but the photograph that you've seen a few times and maybe seen over the course of the years that captures the experience, but you're seeing it from that perspective, from someone else's perspective. Yeah,
exactly. Like all these images are so clear to me. Like the last verse, I don't remember how you left me. Was I crying in the bed? Like I can remember that moment and knowing. And then there's, you know, you're already gone inside your head. You know, like I knew like he was way ahead of me in the whole process. Like the divorce wasn't my doing or my what I wanted. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, he's standing in the doorway and I'm in the bed and like he's just. He's gone and he's been gone for a long time. And I'm just learning about these things, you know? And I think for me too, some people process things differently. And I mean, I still am emotionally processing this stuff. And he is just joking around with me like it never happened, you know? Like he's gotten beyond it. And it's like, well, what the heck? You know, like I'm still in it. So I think that's where the prism is interesting. People move on from things in different ways.
Yeah. So you say that's the best thing about time is the ability to forget. Is that?
That's what she's saying.
Yeah.
Doesn't always work that way, but yes.
Right. Yeah. Right. Or maybe not forget, but it does dilute it a little bit, or at least make it a little bit more palatable, I guess, if that's the right word to use. So as you created this song, tell me about the process of writing it. How did it start? What, you know, was there a line that you started with? Start with a chorus, do you recall?
I don't remember. Usually I start with like a guitar riff. So probably that little picky pattern that I do at the beginning is where I started. And, I think I probably just started the song.
So, and did you start out wanting to write this song, or did that pick pattern, was it like an open canvas right now? I'm going to use this pattern for something. I don't know what yet. Or were you focused on this at the time and said, I'm going to write this song about this?
Yeah. I don't necessarily plan what I'm going to write about. Sometimes I'll write down little lines here and there that maybe will be good somewhere sometime. Mm-hmm. But I usually just start and then I realize what I'm writing about probably halfway through.
You know, it's so true that the words just kind of come and it's sometimes I think it's like reading one of these kind of crime novels where all these things are happening all over the place. And yet they start getting tied together as you read it. And it's the same thing with the song. It's like, oh, there's actually something I'm finding involuntarily
yes.
that I'm writing about something. I'm not really sure what I'm writing about, but I know it's there.
Yes. I think that's the most exciting thing for me about writing. That's what yeah. I love, that process. The process of it, I love, because I figure things out that I didn't know before. And I'm a very non-crafty writer. Like I don't go in with ideas. And in fact, if I do go in with an idea, or if something takes me a long time to work out, then it's usually not a very good song. And I'm very much in life, like I'm very much a planner, and I'm very like responsible, and I show up and I do everything the way I need to do. So when I'm writing, the fact that it comes like that is like my saving grace, like my yeah. creativity. So
it's the one place where you don't need to plan ahead.
Yes, just exactly.
Kind of let things go. Do you find yourself writing a lot now, or have you taken a hiatus at any time? And the reason I ask is I feel like I'm in this hiatus, and I'm trying to figure out what I think that I'm sort of goal oriented, and I need to have a reason to write something, because so many songs I write just end up, you know, going, not necessarily going anywhere. So I'm actually recording all these old songs that I wanted to do something with, you know, 10 years old, and finally just getting them out of my system. You yeah. know, I said, I want to finally do something with this. And so I asked myself, well, why am I adding more songs in that I'm, who knows what I'm ever going to do with, you know, and how many albums can you put out, you know, that nobody's going to buy. So I find I'm a little goal oriented, but at the same time, when someone gives me a song challenge, I go, well, you know, I don't know that I really want to write about that. You know, yeah. just because you say I should, I don't know that I want to.
That's why I don't take songwriting classes, because I'm like, I can't, I'm not good like that. Well, that's not why I write. I don't write like, I don't know. I don't want it to be an exercise. It's like acting. Like once it became a job, yeah. and it was like, oh, okay. Then there was all this pressure, and then my creativity kind of dried up, you know? So I think, I can't write on spec. Like if someone said, write a song about this, it wouldn't be that I didn't want to, but I don't think it would be a very good song. You know, I mean, some people write really well that way. Some people go yeah. in with ideas and like, you know, like Mark Stepakov, he's a great songwriter. Mm-hmm. He talks about it like an assembly line. Like he has these ideas and they, you know, and he just kind of works on them. And then the next song comes up and I think that's so cool, but it's just, I very opposite from what I do.
So he may be working on one at a time. Is that what you're saying? And you're not?
Yeah. He always has an idea in the wings, but it's always like starts with the idea and then he works it and he, you know, which is a great, you know, I wish I had more of that, but I do it. I have, you know, this stage of the game, I've kind of accepted my process.
Yeah,
I think so. I haven't taken a hiatus. I there are dry spells. You know, there are certainly times when I'm like, I'm never going to write another song again. But I do, so yeah. somehow.
there's always something. There's always a topic, whatever it might be. You've got kids heading off that may be heading off to college and going through all that process.
Yes.
And there's a whole different thing. I love the production of it, and I assume that Doug did the production on this. I noticed that I made a note here on your lyric sheet about when the mandolin comes in. I think it's a mandolin that comes in.
In the last verse, there's a banjo.
Yes. Is it only the last verse? I thought I heard that earlier. Maybe, perhaps not. There's a lot of picking. There's a lot going on.
There's a lot of picking. Yeah.
But the mandolin was you're laughing across the table telling stories I should know. I can't recall a single moment, and that's the beauty of letting go.
Yes.
And there's the mandolin, and boy, whenever you add that instrument in, it's something else.
Yeah.
It just creates this little high tinny timber in the song, and it's almost like a way of you can add an accordion in or something like that, which does kind of the same thing. It all of a sudden takes you out into a different place. I have to listen to this again and look for that banjo. But you've got a lot going on, and it's great, and I love the way that you start. Perhaps it's just you and the guitar, maybe a little percussion. And then here comes the bass, boom, you know, gives us that gravity and then just starts filling in. And I always love songs that just build up like that.
Yeah, Doug did an amazing job with it. He really, it's just very tasteful and very, and it moves along emotionally the way the song moves emotionally. You know, when that mando comes in, it's like, it does create this other world and emphasizes.
But nothing becomes overpowering in this.
No.
You know, it's a gradual thing. And unless you're listening like I was, you don't necessarily hear this stuff building up. It just builds up.
Yeah.
And I always think that that really adds a lot. It's a beautiful song. When you wrote the refrain to this, I've had occasionally had a songwriting coach say, you've got too many rhymes.
Okay.
And you've got mind and behind and mind and time. And did you think about that at all? Or did you run? Do you run through some lyric changes? And I'm not saying this in a critical way at all, because I disagree with the person who will remain nameless, who told me you've got too many rhymes, because sometimes it really works well. But I just wondered, in the course of your writing this, do you got a lot on the cutting room floor? Not this one, at least.
No, I don't. You know, it's funny. Like I have, I'll show you like my notebooks, because I write by hand, longhand in a composition book. And like, I rarely, unless we're putting out a record or somebody needs my lyrics, I don't tend to type them out. And then if you look through my notebooks, the songs that are kind of like, I don't know, not the best, I won't say that, but the songs that are really like, the songs that are mine, you know.
You can say the best. That's okay.
Well, I mean, good song. Well,
your best songs.
The better songs. My better songs are ones that don't have a lot of stuff on the cutting room floor. Like you look at what I've written. Maybe there are a couple of things crossed out, but generally the meat of the song is there. So, and I don't think about things like rhymes. I think that rules. I don't know. Songwriting rules sometimes work, but then you have to be. You have to throw them out the window sometimes because they can be limited too. I mean, you know, some of the best songs have, you know, the like Moon Spoon June, you know, like have those kinds of rhymes and they still get you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I it was just sort of my way of leading into the question of whether or not you do a lot of rewriting.
No.
And at least with this one, you don't. You go in, you're confident and you say, this works. And, you know, if it does, it does. Does Doug, do you guys bat things around back and forth?
We do sometimes. We both have kind of fragile egos. So we're both very solitary writers. We've tried to write together and it just hasn't worked. But I think we both know now how to add to each other's song without taking away from who the other person is as a writer.
Yeah.
You know, we really respect that about each other. So,
and I guess if you're writing about your own divorce, you really should just be the only one writing about your
divorce. Yeah. I mean, what I love, I'll tell you my favorite part of the process is when you're fixing things like pronouns, like, or little adjectives or little words, like that's where the editing for me comes in. Like maybe there's like a line where I'm like, that's just not scanning right. Or that doesn't feel exactly right. That's not exactly what I want to say. Or that metaphor is not exactly what I want. And then I'm like, I'll be driving and it's in my head, or I'll be walking the dog and it's in my head. Like that's my favorite part. Like that's the editing that I do, which I love.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. Well, it's fun to have that. I mean, why wouldn't you want to improve a song?
Right.
You know,
absolutely.
You know, like anything else, you know, an athlete, whatever it is, they're always, you know, you're always trying to improve something.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you can do it, you can do it. But, you know, in this case, if it works and if it's right.
Yeah. I mean, I'm totally open to critique and people's input, you know, and you know why you wrote something a certain way, or if somebody's not hearing it the way you want them to hear it, then maybe you have to think about it and say, okay, well, what do I need to shift something, or do I just like it? And, you know, who cares?
I like your stubborn attitude. I do.
But I'm surprising myself as I speak because I'm really not this confident. But I think, you know, I just songwriting is I feel like it's my process. When I went into music therapy, that's when I had first started writing songs and I found them very therapeutic for myself. So I said, okay, I'm going to be a therapist and work with people like me and have them, help them write songs that are therapeutic for themselves, right? Mm. So, but then when I started my programs, I was like, and I tried to do that, I hated it because it was like, I don't have a process and I don't feel like, I don't know, it's maybe selfish, but I wanted to keep my songwriting for myself. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Not that I don't write songs for the kids I work with or do stuff like that, but like, I couldn't work with somebody like me. I would drive myself crazy. Like, So I feel like I'm a little protective of it, maybe a little too protective, but I'm not super confident. It's just I don't want to mess it up. I don't want to ruin it. You know what I mean?
So I assume you haven't really done a lot of co-writing with anybody aside from Doug. Yeah.
Mark Stepakoff and I co-wrote a song, but the way it went was, I don't have any funny songs. So this was my only funny song. And it was about all these crazy experiences I had online dating. And so I gave Mark the experiences and he basically wrote the song came, you know, and we kind of batted back and forth with some lines and some rhymes, but like, that's how it went. Like, here's my experience. And he wrote the song. So that's my only real co-writing. Yeah.
Mark, I think, was my second guest on this podcast.
He's great.
I think it was. Yeah, he is. He's very funny. Your album is for With the Lie Twos is, tell me the name of it again.
The most recent one is called The Worst Kind of New.
That's right. And I think that's Doug's song that we interviewed him about, if I recall, right? Yep. The Worst Kind of New. Yeah.
Yep.
And your website, your personal website is SusanJLevine.com.
.com,
right? Mm-hmm. And and then also there's the Lie Twos music.
Yeah, and that website, LieToMusic.com. Yeah.
LieToMusic.com. That's right. And there's a lot of music on there. You've got a lot going on, a lot of great career. And it's wonderful that music is really the focus of it. You're very lucky.
Yeah, thank you.
Keep putting it out there, one way or the other. I'll log in for some music therapy sometimes and go to your website and just listen and get some music therapy myself.
Thank you. This was so much fun, Steve. Thanks. You asked great questions. It was really fun to think about these things and talk about
them. Oh, thank you. All right. Susan Levine, thank you. I really appreciate you joining us on Song Creating. It was great to see you.
You too. Thanks so much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Song Creating on Radio St. Pete. If you like what you hear, you can find Song Creating on your favorite podcast app or at songcreating.com. To check out my own music, go to steverobb.com. And until next time, keep a song in your head and music in your heart. Thanks for listening.